Good evening, anarchists everywhere, and welcome to tonight's Anarchism in the UK. I'm Ian Bone, and tonight's guest is Skunk. Welcome, Skunk.
Hello, Ian. How are you doing?
Okay, let's get straight in there. Anarchist speed dating. That's a new one on me, but you're behind the speed dating session for anarchists coming up on Friday. Tell us all.
Well, on one of the collective, it's actually on Saturday, Valentine's Day, We thought we'd have a bit of fun with Valentine's. I mean, he's the patron saint of flower sellers, and who really wants to give him any more money? They've got quite enough. So what we thought we'd do is get all the anarchos with a sense of humour, all of those left with a sense of humour, together on Saturday night for our own little Valentine's bash. Obviously, everyone's welcome, but it's up at the Cross Kings, which is just up York Way off King's Cross. And to be honest, we just thought it'd be a giggle, and I think it will be. There's some good bands on after the speed dating, and the speed dating itself is obviously non-denominational, as we say. Any sex, sexuality or anything else is certainly welcome.
Oh, brilliant. A return to our narco-hedonism. We haven't had enough of that lately. Down with miserabilism. So it sounds like a fun night then.
Exactly, yeah. We just thought we'd have a giggle, to be honest. We organised it with some friends of ours who quite involved in class war now, and they just thought of the idea, and we thought, great, let's run with that.
And you've got a strict mistress running the proceedings?
We do indeed. We have a dominatrix running affairs with her. She'll be cracking the whip and keeping everyone in everyone in place, and apparently some of the worthies from some quite infamous punk bands are turning up in costume, and I don't mean drag, so that should be interesting too.
I hope we're getting our arses whipped, no doubt.
Well, indeed.
The new anarcho-hedonism movement started by Skunk. Another thing you're involved with is the No Sweat campaign, which is slightly different.
Yes, I've been... Jay, who really has been one of the sort of main people who runs No Sweat with a chap called Mick, who's both very hard-working, and there's other people involved in the organisation, but I like what they do and what they say, so I've started doing quite a lot of stalls.
What is it? What is No Sweat?
Well, No Sweat, I mean, I think the easy thing to say would be that they're an anti-sweatshop organisation, but actually they're a bit more positive than that. They're very pro-union. They're not saying boycott everything that was made somewhere where it shouldn't be made. Rather, let's unionise those workplaces, get people active. And actually, they've got a DVD, which I think they usually give away, which has got some great riot porn on it from workers' strikes and stuff like that. You know, they're a very sound organisation, and I've really enjoyed the bits and bobs I've done for them.
OK. Let's go. That's what you're doing now. Let's go back to when you first got involved in politics. When was that? Where were you, and how did you first get involved?
It was a million years ago. I'm from London originally. I'm from West London, and... I suppose I always realised that my politics were very different from, or that I had politics, I suppose. I went to a Catholic school, and that taught me very quickly that I had a very different viewpoint from the people who were around me, from my peer group, as it were. So I started looking elsewhere, and I read something about anarchism, and I can't exactly remember where or what it was now, but I read about it as being something that was being damned. Whatever I read about it was saying, you know, these mad anarchists are wrecking things, and I thought, that sounds like it. That sounds much more fun. And I was pretty much ostracised at school for having such radical views, which was interesting because, you know, in the school before I was ostracised for being a Catholic, then I was ostracised for not being a Catholic. And, you know, by the end you think, well, what's left for me must be anarchism.
And when did you first actually sort of come across actual real anarchists as opposed to reading about them?
I think probably at punk gigs and at stalls, and I was involved quite early in the anti-Nazi league. Well, quite early, I mean quite early for me. I was quite young, in sort of 79, and I was hanging around those circuits, and there were a few anarchists around. Interestingly, 78, 79, there weren't that many punk anarchists. There were, they were starting to build up, but they weren't, you know, these were often sort of older people with long hair and beards who were...
That was just the women.
Exactly. And firm handshakes. But no, good comrades, and I had some good mentors then. And then, of course, 78, 79, anarchist punk exploded, and I was away. I had bands that believed in what I believed in, and...
I guess the anti-Nazi League then actually meant something. It wasn't just a load of people standing with yellow lollipops asking the police to arrest fascists. It actually got stuck in. So it's a bit of a different kettle of fish than the revamped SWP version.
Yeah, I mean, Red Action was still totally immersed in the anti-Nazi League at the time. You know, they were all members at that time, and they're not people who sit around waiting for something to happen or who wave lollipops. They take the problem to the people causing it, and they deal with it there. And so I saw some of that going on, and that seemed more interesting than other stuff.
Well, I guess you might just missed Rock Against Racism at its height, but still added a big appeal, didn't it, and the ANL to sort of young kids at the time.
I was very sorry I missed the Rock Against Racism gig, and I think I must have been just literally too young, I don't know. I was thinking about that because people talk about the age people get involved and they say, oh, well, he's only 21. I was thinking, well, I don't know, in those days a lot of us were squatting, active anarchists from the ages of 15, 16, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe we grew up a bit quicker, I hope I don't get hammered for saying that, but I think times were a bit harder. And so people kind of made their own way quite young and got on with it. And also, you weren't expected to be living with your mum and dad when you were 17, were you?
So punk came on the scene. How did that hit you? When did you first see a punk band? When did you first hear about it? Was it the Sex Pistols? Who was it?
Certainly wasn't the Sex Pistols, although I probably saw some of that kind of peacock punk on Top of the Pops. But I did see local punk bands around, some of which, you know, it's like, was he enjoying punk rock or not? Well, you could argue either way, but he was certainly fantastic, and without punk he probably wouldn't have had a platform, and he was probably one of the best performers of my lifetime. But the thing that caught me at the time, because I was young and angry, and I thought religion was shit, I thought money was shit, I thought capitalism was shit. I probably wouldn't have even called it capitalism then, but I realised there was all this kind of intense corruption of a massive scale going on. And then Crass happened, and, you know, Crass was saying, yeah, it's all a load of shit, and have a go at it.
And did you actually see Crass perform? Or?
I interviewed Crass. I did the famous Anarchy Peas and Chips interview with Tom Vague.
Oh, really? Tell us all.
I haven't seen him for years, but he was an old mate of mine. I think we were squatting in a Paragon in Bath. I ended up in Bath for a convoluted stuff I won't go into, but... See, Tom was squatting in the Paragon. I think I was squatting down the road with the... Well, anyway. And we caught the train to Ongar from Bath to interview them. And the snow was like it was last week. And I think it took us 9 hours to get to Ongar from Bath.
That puts Chairman Mao's long march into perspective, comrades.
Indeed. But luckily, Tom had had a... You know how people have hobbies. Joseph Porter from Zounds, famously as a train spotter. And I know him very well, having... roadied for the mob for a while. But our Tom Vague was trying to reconstruct a British Rail toilet from things he'd stolen. So the journey was...
In his own house,
yeah. So the journey wasn't that boring.
Tom Vague's house is like a toilet.
I think he was trying to build a BR toilet from stolen bits of BR toilet. So the train journey wasn't as boring as it... Also, being with Tom's always going to be amusing. And when we were interviewing Crass...
Did you interview them, the whole collective, together, or was it just a couple?
Steve, Penny, and bits of other people came in and out of the interview. Yeah. Penny, as usual, Penny was very much the controlling influence of Crass, and I think he would say himself a bit of a, you know, he wanted it to be the way he wanted it to be. Steve was interesting, and although a few years older than me, very much of the same kind of, you know, angry young punk, really. Good bloke. And... there was a lot of kids in the collective just knocking about. I'm sure they were people's kids, but it wasn't acknowledged whose they were, you know, it was quite an... And in the middle of the interview, one of them comes, kicks the door open and goes, well, what's for dinner? And I think someone said, oh, hey, can I have Anarchy Peas and Chips in? And it was just great, you know, it was a sort of 7-year-old kid, you know.
When was that? Was that when Crass was still the sort of pacifist Crass before they sort of changed their ideas later on after the miners' strike? So that was when their pacifism was sort of all pervasive in the...
This would have been the early 80s, yeah. And I remember myself, I was very attracted by the early Crass view on pacifism, because having seen them, I knew they'd hop off the stage and whack us, you know, when the British movement used to attack their gigs, And they used to attack us all the time. As a young punk, I was forever getting lamped by bikers or skinheads. Even though I was, you know, a skinhead.
Yeah, I mean, just I think people in sort of provincial cities all over Britain were getting thumped.
Punch punks, yeah.
Where they looked, yeah.
And we were all we were tiny little people, you know. That's the thing. When I was 16, I was a good 5 stone lighter than I am now and probably the same height. So I was a spindly little, you know, I was fun to punch because I fell over, you know, bled a bit, you know.
And it's fun to punch. That's an even better title than the peas and shit.
Indeed.
And, I mean, did you go the whole hog with Crass? Did you sort of wear the clothes and buy every record?
I was a magnificent
Crass punk tattoo being revealed to us.
And the Poison Girls as well.
Poison Girls as well.
Who I was absolutely fascinated by Poison Girls because much as I loved the roar and scream of Crass, and I loved some of the earlier punk bands. I'm not a great Pistols fan, but I loved X-Ray Specs and bands like that. So when you hear Poison Girls, suddenly you've got the politics and some music. And it was great to hear that, you know, and I really was a big fan of Poison Girls.
And then you managed to did some roadieing, did you say, with the Mob and Poison Girls? How did you come from sort of callow youth Crass clone to a major role as a roadie in the punk movement?
Yes, well, there's a slightly devious sexual story there. I don't know.
Well,
yeah, I'm not
it's
sure.
Quarter past six on a Sunday.
Oh, it might be a bit early.
This is often
for
the
this.
God slot, so.
Bit early for this, but.
readers, listeners can make private applications for my blog afterwards for full details. But you roadie with Poison Girls.
I met a bloke at a gig and ended up roadieing with the Mob, who were with, and of course Joseph Porter from Zounds was actually at some point during that period he was playing for them as well, and that was great. And they had an affinity with, and I can't remember why, but the Redskins, if you remember them.
Yeah.
Neither Washington nor Moscow, but International Socialism. Sorry,
it falls off the tongue. Try not to laugh.
But who were a sound bunch of anti-fascists as well. So much as, you know, they were very SWP, but they were sound militant anti-far. And, you know, that was very, all of those, that political bent was important to me, anti-far, animal rights.
With the narco-punk, I mean, there's two ways of looking at it. It brought a lot of people into anarchism, which certainly did and certainly Crass did. But on the other hand, the sort of time I was to London around about 82, I mean, they just seemed to be getting people to go to endless squat gigs and actually get them, you know, not go on the streets. So it was a narco-punk was a scene, but it was squat gig after squat gig, which is fine, but it didn't actually bring any people out of the streets. It took a lot of people off the streets, in my opinion, as well.
Stop the City was largely a narco-punk thing.
It was,
and a lot of the demos at the time, the early Black Blocs, the big scraps that went off with the coppers at Greenham, a lot of the anarcho-feminists who were the Greenham women. But you're right, I mean, to a degree, maybe a bit more could have been done about street politics. Crass would credit themselves with having a lot to do with Rock Against Racism and CND, and probably a lot of people would never have gone hunt-sabbing if it wasn't for Crass, conflict, all of those things.
Yeah.
However, bar Stop the City and the Black Blocs, on, which weren't called Black Blocs, but the big groups of us that turned up on every demo and had it with the coppers if it was coming on... they didn't actually, they weren't telling us to go do that. There was no, but you know what I mean. They weren't even suggesting it, really. Except Stop the City, which I think was largely
that. There was, I mean, you mentioned already, it was interesting that early 80s experience when all sorts of different strands of anarchism came together as punk, animal liberationists, anarcho-feminists. Well, they all cooperated a lot more. And then the big strand, I guess, was animal liberation. And you got involved in that. How did that come about?
Yeah, I got very involved in sabbing, partly because I ended up in the West Country from London, and when you see it out there, these wankers in their red coats, you know which person in the red coat you support, and it's the small furry one, you know.
You foxes listening out there?
Yeah, they're all out, and the foxes are all waiting for me. But it's a great way to have a proper... You actually feel like you're doing something. You get muddy, you get cold, but you also have a fight with some rich...
Yeah, that's always been the appeal of it for me.
And that's something that, of course, you're not necessarily used to, and you don't necessarily get that close to what is basically our enemy, sworn enemy, an enemy that would kill us at the first opportunity.
A class enemy on a horse in front of you, yeah.
And, of course, in Sabin, there is an awful lot of violence directed to us. The police have always, and it's still going on now, the police have always turned a blind eye to anything the Hunts do, including the death of a couple of comrades over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the only thing, I suppose a bit like the thing you were saying about some of the anarcho-punk, that it didn't always contribute to other things that were going on. And I think the trouble with the animal rights movement is it did pull people. Hunt sabs were going out once a week or twice a week. Workers, you know, spending an awful lot of money, putting an awful lot of effort into sabbing when there was other things that they could have been doing more effectively. And I think that became, for me, that I recognised that at some point and realised that there was a broader church, if I can call it that, than just hunt sabbing and animal rights.
But people did manage to do lots of different things, weren't they? People were hunt sabbing, yes, squat gigs, and ultimately multi-dimensional. Tell us about your first experience of violence on a hunt sab, or, you know, directed at you. Or
first time I went out, I mean, I'd had a go at hunts around my area, and around where I was squatting with the mob in Wiltshire. We'd had a bit of a pop at them, a few of us down there. But when I first went on a formal hunt sab, it was with the old Bristol hunt sabs, who were quite a lumpy lot, actually, good good lads, and lassies, of course.
Yeah.
But they didn't mind a scrap. And they were run by a chap called Ian Pedler, who was a right old character, well-known old character, but he hated hunting to the degree where he lost it the minute he saw them. And I went out with my girlfriend at the time, who was part half Burmese. And the first bloke pulls up, this fucking huge great bloke on this massive horse, pulls up and starts giving her the kind of racist abuse that I would drop anyone for saying now, then, or at any other time. I couldn't believe it. And I said, are you in the fucking National Front, you whatever? And he said, bloody would be if I could find a membership card. And I thought, you really are my enemy. And I just got, and I was, at the time, I thought I was a pacifist, I think, just about. Yeah. All I'd ever been was beaten up. I was never big enough to. And I just started trying to have this bloke off his horse, and I was jumping up and smacking him, and I just lost the plot and realised that, A, I realised I wasn't a pacifist. B, I realised that my enemy really were as bad as I thought they were.
Yeah.
And that probably, that kind of thing, kept me sabbing for many years. And actually, in a way, some of my political activism got wrapped up in that. And I think that's probably the same for a lot of people, because once you've been out there and they've smacked the shit out of your best mate, it's personal, and you go
until
back.
Until you see the ruling class in person, you don't actually realise how ghastly they are. You just think it's a bit of a caricature.
It's absolutely true.
It's a bit of a caricature. It's like when you went to the Henley Regatta and people could not believe how awful that the people there were. They thought it was like a made-up caricature. But as soon as you see them, your flesh begins to creep. And you get
absolutely. What was that, the ruling class, rich, thick, full of clots, all of that, like Devon cream?
Oh, and the other thing, there's Hunt Sab, and then there was the Animal Liberation Front and Animal Liberationism, which is, you know, some of the same people, but somewhat different. And you got involved in the Animal Liberation Movement.
Yeah, I was very involved. For me, that was a direct attack on capitalism, and therefore I viewed it as an anarchist statement. I viewed sabbing as certainly being along those lines, and taking direct action of any form against anything as being putting your money where your mouth is, putting your feet where your mouth is. And I also thought that the damage that was done to various organisations at the time served two purposes. It's the one struggle, one fight, human freedom, animal rights, you know. You're having a go at a major capitalist power. You're also, you also felt you were lightening the burden on the animals that people use and abuse.
So did you actually go out and rescue animals? Or?
I think no comments probably the best answer.
Spotted that one coming. Chief Inspector Bone got what you asked for there. And do you feel the same about animal liberation now? You know, I mean, would you extend that to, you know, the sort of Ronnie Lee's view that, you know, all sentient life is the same, a head louse and a human, they're all to be valued equally? Or?
I think there's a lot to be said for it, and I think that it's very difficult to argue with a moral high ground, isn't it? So you can't argue with a vegan that they're doing something stupid, can you? Because what they're doing is ultimately taking things to a positive extreme, and once again, they're actually taking direct action in their own lives. However, I mean, certainly, when Archangel, which was the ALF magazine for a while, was, well, not the ALF, it was a shoot-off of it, but was publishing letters from people in the far right, I just think that you've actually mixed it too far now. And there certainly were elements in the mid-late 80s of infiltration from the far right, and I would say now that there were certain people up at the top of those organisations, although we didn't officially have a leadership, we were meant to be anarchist, we did have the anarchy A around the ALF, but there were certain people at the top of the organisation who were not worried by the far right being involved.
Yeah.
I obviously personally was, and I was the Hunt Sabs very quickly came out and did what every borough council does now and says, you know, we're not going to have any racist or sexist in the organisation, basically. And we threw out the infamous Maggie Flynn at the time, who, whilst herself may not have been a racist, I don't know that. Yeah. I certainly met her. Her husband had a shrine to Hitler in their front room. And we thought that was a little bit distasteful.
Yeah, I thought so. Talking of Hitler, this was the time of Margaret Thatcher. I mean, all these tendencies was there. You know, the punk, the Hunt Sabs, the anti-fascism, the anti-Nazi League stuff. And then Thatcher came along. And then in 1985, you had, which is probably a watershed for most people, certainly for Crass, I think, and a change from pacifism. I mean, the miners' strike was like a lesson for everyone. People's politics moved on quickly. How was that for you?
We went out on that, and it was interesting because some of the early Hunt Sabs, Hunt Sabs tend to be more your vegan type now, but in those days, a lot of them were sort of SWP types, actually, or anarchists, you know, as much as anything. So they were quite up for a scrap and a class war, and some of them would be more likely to eat a bacon butty. Because they took me out, even though I was, you know, 80... they took me out on political stuff when I was quite young. So by the time the miners' strike came, the people's pickets and stuff like that, I was fully involved in all of that and very much felt that the bit that we did do, supporting the miners, was probably one of the most important things that we were doing at the time. And that was gigs and that was organising meetings and that was also just taking stuff down to them so that they could eat properly. But the brutality, the publicly shown brutality of the police, is the true face of Maggie Thatcher. And, you know, I'd love to carve that on her gravestone.
Yeah, I went to see Billy Elliot the other week, and the biggest cheer of the night was when the miners were seeing they dance on Thatcher's grave, and which I think people have still got a lot of hatred and quite properly antagonism towards it. Did that then, the miners' strike, did that lead you into class war? And was that later? Was that led you into general?
It was later for me. I was still very involved in animal rights stuff and other sort of anarchist activity. But I knew of class war, but didn't think it was going to... I actually thought anarchism was going to be so big that I didn't see the point of any particular little group here or there.
Yeah.
Even though class war was hardly a little group, and to be honest, I wish I'd got more involved, because I think I was short-sighted and idealistic. I mean, in 1985, I was 20 or whatever, and I honestly thought it was going to happen, because Thatcher was so bad and so many people hated her. I really thought we were going to crack it and change it, and, you know, and I thought all of the parties, the groups, the WRP, the RCP, but also the ones on our side. So I thought, well, you know, it's a dilution, you know, don't worry about it, we're going to have a revolution.
Well, I think it was a close-run thing, the miners' strike. If the inner-city riots like Tottenham and Brixton got up at the same time, it would be a damn close-run thing. We've only got 5 minutes left. Let's move fast-forward again. I mean, you're still a big follower of going to punk gigs and so on. What are the bands today that you rate, or not just, you know, punk, but musicians who've got some politics and they're still doing...
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that. There are some good bands out there. I mean, the trouble is we're regurgitating a lot of stuff. So a lot of the bands that are doing good political stuff are just, you know, an updated Crass or an updated Conflict.
There's nothing sadder than seeing some old punk band from about 20 years ago.
Exactly.
With the leather studs on, whacking it out, war, animal lib sort of stuff.
And yeah, but I mean, bands like Active Slaughter, I mean, they're, you know, they're young punks who I think they're very vegan, but they've got a good sound and they're quite a tight together unit. I like the way they play, I like the way they sing, and I like their politics. I don't like thrash punk, even if it's singing politically, probably because I'm too old, Ian, and I hear that noise and I can't hear what they're talking about. And I'm sure everyone said that about the music I was listening to 20 years ago.
I know you mentioned Head Jam earlier in the pub, and I think you...
Head Jam are a fantastic band, and I suppose the mellowing for any punk is Scar. I think when you grow up, you find Scar, and I love Scar, and Head Jam are a nice combination of Scar and punk. Very mellow.
But we know you're also into folk, because we know you're a big Rob Johnson fan as well.
I am a big folkie, and of course the Pogues to me were, you know, if you're away from politics and into just music, 1985, the Pogues hit the scene. I had already heard them a couple of times at Republican things, and they were absolutely, what a wonderful combination. Punk and folk at that speed. Can't go wrong with that.
You've managed to maintain a sort of a commitment to action for about 30 years without getting fed up and cynical and withdrawing from it. What is it that sort of keeps you going with optimism for change? Because not everyone's got it.
They make me that fucking angry. They just make me so angry when you see them and when you... Carol Thatcher, fucking hell. And, you know, when you hear about some stupid, whinging, rich prat who's hopefully just want to see them all jump off the top of Lehman's, the whole lot of them, one by one, you know. And I'm not a cruel person, but...
He's not. But there are witnesses.
But the pain that they inflict on the world through their complete arrogance, and as you say, when you meet them, it's true. It's not, they're not faking it. They are arrogant bastards. They think they own this world, and they think they can do what they like with it and the people in it. And that's why I'm in class war.
We've got about 3 minutes left. You said when we were talking earlier you had a message for the youth of today, or what you actually said was, I've got a rant about the youth of today. Here's your 3 minutes.
Turn your computer off. Stop playing games or playing with yourself. Get out there. The only place that things change, the only time you can change anything, is if you're physically there when it's happening. Don't sit at home. Get out there, do it, join the revolution, because if you don't, it'll be too late for you and for your kids. So there's a lot going on. There are people still around who are keeping these things going, but we'd actually like to see a lot more young blood. And I think one of the reasons is that there's a kind of apathy has set in, and people aren't used to taking it to the streets. They're not used to taking it back to people. And that's what needs to happen.
Yeah, some people seem to have a sort of virtual revolution by just commenting on internet discussion boards, adopting a more prolier than now position and advocating world revolution, but never getting outside their mum's bedroom or something.
I think that's absolutely right. And I've always been, I've never really been somebody who'd been to message board sites for any reason, anarchism or anything else. I don't, but that's not because I'm a Luddite and I don't think we should use it. I think we should use it all we can. I just think that when it comes to doing what we do or what we believe in, anarchism is actually about what you do, not what you say, and certainly not what you write on lib.com.
And I guess a big opportunity to get out on the streets is coming up. The G20 Summit of World Leaders is in London on April the 1st, April the 2nd. There's going to be huge demonstrations called outside the Bank of England on the 1st, and then actually at Excel in East London on the 2nd. So
yeah.
I guess that's going to be a great opportunity.
I mean, that's particularly, I mean, you know, I meet a lot of young people who are sound, you know, and I'm not slagging them off when I'm ranting at them. I'm not saying that their views aren't right and good and sound. I'm saying that they need to get out and do more about it. And this is a real opportunity for the people of Britain and Europe, because I assume it will be mostly people who won't be travelling halfway around the world to have a go at them, but to show them that they're not welcome here, that they are... It's not just that they pollute the earth, they're destroying the earth, but they're also the sworn enemy of our class, and of all people and animals, in my view. So yeah, it'd be a great opportunity for people to get out on the streets and tell them what we think.
Yeah, I think it's going to be the people's Europe versus the bankers' Europe. OK, thanks a lot, Skunk. That's been brilliant. Covered a lot of ground there. I'll be back the same time next week when I'll be talking to Jane Clementson from Freedom Press about 25 years of Freedom Press.